1 Samuel 17. All right, you know 1 Samuel 17 is about David's battle with Goliath. And last time we finished down around verse 36 or 37 where David comes out to fight him. And we were discussing, since everybody knows the outturn of that battle, that David killed Goliath with a stone and a sling and then cut his head off. We were closed last time talking about, it seems like maybe slinging a stone wouldn't be that great a weapon, but we determined mathematically, actually, the science proves that, when we compared like a 9mm bullet's momentum, when you take an 8 or 9 gram bullet, have it travel 365 meters per second. That's a kind of big number. But when you compare a sling, where if a guy can sling it at 60 meters per second, something that's a golf ball size, which is about 48 grams or a little more, many rocks would plainly weigh more than a golf ball, that when you do the math, that there's more momentum to a 60-gram rock being flung at 60 meters per second than a 9mm bullet. So pretty impressive. So yes, that could kill somebody, at least knock them out dead, or knock them out until you could kill them. But anyway, down in verse 36, David is explaining his background to Saul, and thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. We'll talk more about that in a second. David said, moreover, the Lord hath delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear. He will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said unto David, go, and the Lord be with thee. And Saul armed David with his armor, and he put on a helmet of brass upon his head. Also he armed him with a coat of mail. And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go. That is, he tested it. He tried to go, for he had not proved it. And David said unto Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off him. And he took his staff in his hand and chose him 5 smooth stones. Now it specifies 5. There might be a reason for that. Because you take into account Goliath, look in 2 Samuel, we were there last week, 2 Samuel 21, and down in verse 15, I don't know if the 5 smooth stones were kind of just an arbitrary number, or if that was all the sack would hold, but we do know this from reading, starting in 2 Samuel 21, verses 15, 16, down through verse 22, that Goliath was the son of the giant, and these other, he's never called a giant, I specified that last time, these 4 guys outlined in 2 Samuel 21, 16 through 22 are also the sons of the giant, and so they are brothers of Goliath. That's 5 giants. And so it specifies that David had picked out 5 smooth stones. So there might have been an indication to him that if he killed one, he might have to kill 4 others. So for one, if that's the case, he's pretty confident to have just chosen 5 stones to take care of 5 brothers. Instead, I would have taken a couple extra rounds, you know what I'm saying? But apparently he was confident enough, if that was the case, to do that. But whether or not that was arbitrary or not, we don't know. But it specifies in verse 40 of 1 Samuel 17, chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had even in a scrip. His sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and of a fair countenance. Now, so he's young. He's kind of got a red complexion, reddish complexion, pinkish complexion, and has a fair countenance. And that fair countenance is defined back in chapter 16, verse 12, where he's again described by the Lord, and he sent and brought him in. Now he was ready and withal of a beautiful countenance. So when someone talks about a fair maiden, they're talking about a beautiful maiden, or for that matter, a fair man. They're talking about a beautiful man. And we don't use beautiful for men too much, but they did, okay? Verse 43. And the Philistine said unto David, am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? I mean, do I look like a dog you can run off with sticks? You sent out this punk kid. You know, it's like, what's the challenge in this? Verse 43, am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves? And the Philistine cursed David by the Philistine's gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then said David to the Philistine, thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come unto thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. Now, that defiance is spoken of five times in this passage. It specifies in verse 10 that the Philistine defied the armies of Israel. In verse 25, he defied Israel. In verse 26, that he should defy the armies of the living God. Again, in verse 36, he had defied the armies of the living God. And now David says that it's the God of the armies of Israel whom thou hast defied. So that defiance goes all the way to God. Now, it's interesting because in that same chapter that I had you in a little while ago, 2 Samuel 21, one of David's other brothers that was killed, 2 Samuel 21, this is the guy that in verse 20, the man of great stature, this also was of the giants. He had on every hand six fingers, on every foot six toes, 4 and 20 in number. He also was born to the giant, and when he defied Israel, so you know, Goliath and his brother, presumably the rest of his brothers, defied Israel. You know, the other guy that stood in defiance was back in Numbers 23. To be in defiance, the idea is to challenge God or challenge the armies of God, that sort of thing. Numbers 23, and that's what Balaam was hired to do. Numbers chapter 23, verse 7. And he took up his parable and said, Balak, the king of Moab, hath brought me from Aram out of the mountains of the east, saying, come, curse me, Jacob, come, defy Israel. How shall I curse whom God hath not cursed? And how shall I defy whom the Lord hath not defied? Okay, so he was called to defy Israel and defy the nation of Israel. So it makes you wonder, I mean, you have these things happen. You wonder how long a nation is going to get by with defying God the way our nation defies God. We, for so long, have been supposed to have been the cream of the crop of the nations. And, of course, one of the things that separated us as a nation was at least if not, you know, out and out Christianity, then at least a relationship to the Bible, to the truth, having at least had a, you know, a familiarity with the light. And now the light's been not just, you know, walked away, but totally rejected. And now more and more, our populace's actions toward God is total defiance. So one day, somebody named Jesus Christ comes back from heaven, angry. And, I mean, squashes some people in the Valley of Armageddon. And he's going to be angry. So, defiance. But that's what Goliath did. So you can see in all this, foretype of an Antichrist, a type of David going out to defeat an Antichrist and all those things. That Antichrist defying God, speaking vile things all the way to the host of the heavens and so on and so forth. That's what the Antichrist is going to do, is run his mouth, among other things. That's what you see happen in public life all the time today. People running their mouths saying wretched, vile things. That's what a campaign is about these days, right? It's just, oppressive. And it should be oppressive for us because we are the children of the living God. All right, verse 46. This day, David says, will the Lord deliver thee unto my hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee. Get down to that in a minute. I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air. So there you have fowls gathered. We said that Goliath, a type of the Antichrist. David, of course, a type of Jesus Christ. They're in a valley, correct? And so one day Jesus Christ comes back in a valley, and what's left in that valley is mushed body parts, mushed bodies that the fowls of the air come and eat. So it's a type of the second coming of Jesus Christ. He says, I will give, in verse 46, the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And so that's going to happen at the second advent. It happened in this scene, isolated historically. And just a couple weeks ago, you heard a sermon here on, there being a God in Israel. David proved that there was a God in Israel that day. Elijah on Mount Carmel, when he defeated 850 prophets of Baal, he proved there was a God in Israel. And then there was the day that Ahaziah was trying to figure out if he was going to die or not. And instead of sending to the prophet Elijah, instead he went and was going to send to Ekron, to false gods, to ask them whether he would be healed. And Elijah told him, it's because you don't believe there's a God in Israel. And so that's a very important thing. It says in verse 46, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. That is something that's still being being proved today, or in dispute today. Most folks don't know the God of Israel. You and I know Him because Israel rejected Him, and then the Lord opened the door for us to get the gospel. But, I mean, to this hour, I mean, here we are in 2022, and all of the disputation in Israel over whether that should be their land and the Palestinian situation, all that stuff. No, sir, there's a God in Israel, and you put your hand on Israel, and you're gonna be in trouble as a nation or as a people. And so that's still playing out to this hour. Think about this being all those many, many years before Jesus Christ was even born. We're talking about 3,000 years ago, and that is still an issue today, that there is a God in Israel. Back to verse 47. And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth, not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and He will give you into our hands. Now he says that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear. The Lord doesn't need sword and spears. He used David's rock, and then David took Goliath's sword and cut his head off. Okay? But it doesn't require the Lord to have a sword and a spear. If you'll recall all the times that the Lord defeated armies without a sword and spear, for instance, You have the case here in 1 Samuel chapter 7. We've just read it not too long ago, where the Lord thundered upon the Philistines, and the thunder was so overwhelming that they fled. When Absalom was killed, the Bible says in that passage, when Absalom came to his end, that they fought that battle in the woods, in a wood, so the forest. And it said that the wood was responsible for more death than the swords of the Israelites. You say, how did that work? I'm not quite sure. I just know that Absalom wound up hanging in a tree by his hair. I never saw that happen before. Did you? So apparently the Lord has some ways of doing things. If, you know, you shouldn't just think of the Lord as being just purely natural, because he does things sometimes that are supernatural. For instance, I can tuck you to a couple more. Think about the fact that in 2 Kings chapter 7, verse 6, that the armies of the Syrians were made to hear a noise that sounded like this huge army attacking, only there was no army attacking. But they fled their camps and fled the battlefield, and they were defeated that way. They were defeated by a noise that wasn't there. Remember the time that the Lord was out and that Israel was out to fight a battle? This was Jehoshaphat, and there were various nations gathered. And he said, I want you to go out and dig a bunch of ditches, because in the morning there's going to be a bunch of water that comes from down Edom way. And the next morning, all of the armies that were surrounding the Israelites roundabout, they woke up, and it looked like this valley that had been dug out with ditches, it's all full of water. The Lord made them think that the water was blood, so they went down into an ambush and got killed. The Lord doesn't need swords and spears to defeat folks. You remember the time in Joshua 10, where again Israel was embattled with the heathen, and the Lord caused stones to fall from heaven, hailstones that weighed 15 talents. So, you know, by the time you have hailstones dropping on you that weigh as much as shot puts, I mean, if you've ever been in a pretty decent hailstorm, a ping pong ball-sized hailstone will do some damage, and a baseball-sized hailstone, you just don't want to get hit with that. Think about a 15-pound hailstone falling all around your army. I mean, guys are getting plugged like crazy. And so the Lord doesn't need a sword and spear. Look, if you will, down in verse 47. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. One time, Elisha struck an entire army with blindness. They just couldn't see. So they got led off into captivity. The Lord doesn't need sword and spear. Verse 48, that's good for us, because the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God, pulling down the strongholds. The Lord can do anything that he wants to do. He really can. It doesn't have to make sense to you. And once in a while, the Lord lets you see something like that. I'm not saying that you get to perform a miracle. I'm saying, though, sometimes you see the Lord perform a miracle. Back to verse 48, and it came to pass, when the Philistine rose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. So he went on the offensive. That might be something worth noting. And David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone and slang it and smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. Now, like I said, if you were curious enough to do so, you can go on YouTube and find guys slinging stones, and the ones that are using a sling that is, you know, less than the length of their arm, you know, just out extending out there, they can be fairly accurate. But once you get a sling that that's 4 feet long, doubled, so it's 4 feet beyond your man, they're getting some great velocities out of it, but then they're having, you know, struggling to hit a target. And yet still, there was a guy that was hitting a target the size of the offering plates on, you know, put up on a plywood board. And so, you know, it can be done, but you just need to know that that was a stage of warfare back in that day. Look, if you will, at a passage in 2 Samuel. Let me see what this is. 2 Samuel 22. Let's see what that is. I've forgotten which one this is, but 2 Samuel 22. Oh, that's not what the one I wanted, but he teaches my hands to war so that a bow of steel is broken by mine arms. It's talking about David's military career, but I'm looking for Judges chapter 20. Judges 20. And in Judges 20:16, you're told that among the Benjamites, now that's actually Saul's tribe, you're told that among all this people, verse 16, Judges 20:16, there were 700 chosen men left-handed. Everyone could sling stones at a hairbreadth and not miss. So I'm standing, you know, the camera is behind several of these guys flinging either golf balls or tennis balls or at times rocks. And, you know, they're slinging and they're missing sometimes significantly. This is saying those guys weren't missing. So you can get good enough to hit a hair. You're getting good enough, you can hit a pop can at, I don't know how far, but you know, from here, think about from here to the back wall is 50 feet or so. I mean, if you could hit a Coke bottle with a sling stone from here consistently, that's almost as good as a pistol, right? Back to 1 Samuel 18 and verse 49. And David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone and slang it, smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sunk unto his forehead. He fell upon his face to the earth. And again, if he's flinging those stones at 60 meters per second, then that stone is going to have more momentum than a 9mm bullet. It's pretty impressive. Verse 50. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone. So the sling is made of the skin of an animal that has died. The stone is something you can pick up on the ground. And so something very common, something very available, something that had to die to deliver this victory. Something that's called, that delivers a stone to the head of a type of the Antichrist. It's a type of Jesus Christ. It's a type of Jesus Christ at Armageddon. Verse 50. And David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling, with a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him. So he smote him. Whether or not he killed him with the stone itself is undetermined, because he goes on to say, but there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine and took his sword, the Philistine sword, drew it out of the sheath thereof and slew him and cut off his head therewith. So that may have been the killing blow. He may have just been knocked out, but cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. Now, he took his head. That may be the reason that a little bit later in the book, in chapter 31, that the Philistines took Saul's head when they slew him. Right, they found him laying dead, and so they took his head and hung it in the temple of their gods. It also may indicate some other things, because think about the fact that in the tribulation, the way the Antichrist kills folks is by beheading them. Right, all those that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus, those martyrs, they rose in the first resurrection. Correct, and so. That's what's going to happen in the Great Tribulation, whom the Antichrist is running, right? Goliath was a type of the Antichrist. Goliath got his head cut off. So the Philistines cut off the head of Saul. And so in the Great Tribulation, here you have a guy that's heading up everybody cutting off people's heads that he doesn't like. Furthermore, John the Baptist, who is a forerunner of Elijah, had his head cut off. So it could be well that Elijah and Moses, who show up as the two witnesses in the tribulation, that's the way they die, with their heads cut off. Now, after 3 days, they what? They rise from the dead, correct? Do you ever think like this? When the rapture comes, everybody's bodies that have gone to dust will recompose out of the dust. I'm thinking, here is Moses and Elijah, and everybody's celebrating because they're dead. Their heads are over there and their bodies over here, and they're raised from the dead. Do the heads roll to the bodies? Or I just wonder about these things. Anyway, verse 31. Cut off his head therewith, but that's the reason the Philistines will have taken Saul's head in a few more chapters here, because they're repaying the Israelites. And cut off his head therewith. When the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. For the third time, Goliath was their champion. Verse 52. And the men of Israel and of Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until they come to the valley and to the gates of Ekron. That's a Philistine city. And the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way to Shearim, even unto Gath, another Philistine city, and unto Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem. But he put his armor in his tent. So he's walking around carrying this decapitated head. He's a manly man anyway, amen? Verse 55. It may have been good to look at, but he had some guts. Verse 55. And when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he said unto Abner, the captain of the host, Abner, whose son is this youth? Now, David had been playing the harp in Saul's presence ever since the evil spirit had been troubling Saul. And my thought about that is just that I'm guessing with all of the... It said that David loved Saul from the very first time he set eyes on him. But, I mean, the indication would be that it's busy enough in the palace around the king's throne that, you know, David was the musician and Saul didn't pay much attention or anything else. So I'm guessing, it's my best explanation for why Saul doesn't know who he is. Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as thy soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell. Abner hadn't paid any attention to him either. Now the interesting thing about that, however, is that a bunch of Saul's servants knew who David was. Go back to chapter 16, verse 18, because some of the servants anyway, at least one of the servants, behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite that is cunning in playing, the harp, and a mighty valiant man, and a man of war, and prudent in matters, and a comely person, and the Lord is with him. So David already had a reputation, at least among some. I don't know if this was a servant that originated somehow around Jesse's family or exactly what, but whatever's the case, Saul didn't even know who he was and had to ask, and Abner didn't know either. Down in 1757, David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine. Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. So in comes David carrying the head of the Philistine into the king's palace, the king's presence. Verse 58, and Saul said to him, whose son art thou young man? And David answered, I am the son of thy servant Jesse the Bethlehemite. Chapter 18, verse 1. And it came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Now, the soul was knit. Let me take you over to Colossians chapter 2 for just a second. Having your soul knit, or heart, at least your heart knit, should not be a foreign thing, considering that you're admonished to it. Colossians chapter 2, and go on down to verse... Colossians chapter 2 and verse 2. Let's start with verse 1. For I would that you knew what great conflict I, Paul, have for you, Colossians, and for them at Laodicea, and for as many as have not seen my face in the flesh, that their hearts might be comforted, being knit together in love, and unto all riches of the full assurance of understanding, to the acknowledgement of the mystery of God and of the Father and of Christ. Your heart in a Bible-believing church should be knit with the hearts of other Christians. They call that unity these days, only it's ecumenism in the world among a lot of liberal Christians. But, you know, for what we have, folks, the riches that we have in knowledge, wisdom, prudence, and foresight from the Scriptures, I mean, some of our hearts should be knit together. It should be a very real thing. Look down in verse 19 as well. Colossians 2:19, where he says, let's start with verse 18. Let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility and worshiping of angels, intruding into those things which he hath not seen, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind, and not holding the capital H head, that's Jesus Christ, from which all the body, this is a spiritual body, by joints and bands, having nourishment ministered and knit together, increaseth with the increase of God. You should feel a kinship with other people in the body of Jesus Christ. One reason folks don't is because they don't get the same teaching from the same Bible. They're taught various different things. They do not have the same authority. The day is long past now where Christians all have the same authority. Because what even people say is the Bible, in most cases, isn't even the Bible. It's a Bible. It's a Bible, kind of. It's a corrupted Bible. But, I mean, to have what you have, first of all, you have to serve together. You have to love one another because you're being taught and preached to constantly. And Jesus Christ is real to all. And your kinship one with another ought to be enough to knit your hearts together. It should be that way. First Samuel, and you know what, there's another, let me see what this is before I move on. Somebody else's heart was knit here. Yeah, that's not what I want. Okay, 18:1. It came to pass when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Now, this has been, you know, the something that's been abused, perverted, and vilified quite a bit. Go on over to 2 Samuel chapter 1 real quick. And all of the perverts and those who think that way want to try to make what David and Jonathan had be something gross and perverted, and of course it's not true. Look in 2 Samuel chapter 1 verse 26. They really use this one. David finds out that both Saul and Jonathan have been killed, and because folks' minds are so twisted, verse 26, I'm distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Jonathan's dead. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me, thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. Okay, so that's been perverted into making those two guys homosexuals. Just like because several of the Marys and several of the women in the New Testament hung around with Jesus Christ and the disciples, then they're, you know, this is makes Jesus somebody's father. He's the father of somebody's bastard child. And that's perverse. That's a product of wicked imaginations. There's no such thing done as thou sayest, but thou feignest them. Fake it out of thine own heart. You imagined it. And they go to the Greek and everything else and try to make it say something it doesn't say. And it's just stupid. And it's maddening. But 1 Samuel 18, verse 2. So David and Jonathan have something special as friends, and it develops again over time as you see it develop. And Saul took him that day, David, and would let him go no more home to his father's house. So he would come in and play for Saul once in a while and then go back home. When this battle was getting all prepared to go, David had gone home to be with Jesse and the sheep. But now he's going to make it where David doesn't go home anymore. Verse 3, then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. I take that to mean Jonathan loved David as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him, gave it to David and his garments, even to his sword and to his bow and to his girdle. And so Saul is sitting there watching that happen and maybe thinking it odd that Jonathan would have so quickly become such a friend to David. And then this happens. Verse 5. And David went out whithersoever Saul sent him and behaved himself wisely. Now, I keep saying this over and over again, but he behaved himself wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted. Now, as far as behaving himself wisely, go to Proverbs chapter 16. Proverbs 16, and this is something you should think about. Folks aren't very prudent, aren't very foresightful these days. Proverbs chapter 16, going down to verse 20. And notice it says, he that handleth a matter wisely shall find good. I have written in the margin of my Bible, oh God, help me, right? But he that handleth a matter wisely, because a lot of times folks just don't handle matters wisely. Back to 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 5, and he behaved himself wisely, and Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people. Now, I don't know how that worked. We already looked at it. David had a reputation already as a valiant man and a man of war. I'm not sure where he got that unless it was from defeating the lion and the bear. But, I mean, Saul elevates him above his men of war, and they accept it, which is weird because this is talking like David is a 17, 18, 19-year-old young man, and he's being elevated, essentially promoted, above David's seasoned men of war. Now, I don't even know how that works, but they accepted him because among those men became David's mighty 400, the 400 mighty men. Verse 5, there's something going on. I'm not sure exactly all that it is. Look in Psalms 144, verse 1. I've often wondered about this. I know the Lord taught David. 144, 1. Blessed be the Lord, my strength which teacheth my hands to war and my fingers to fight. David gave him that homage. But also notice chapter 18 of Psalms. Psalms 18, 34. Psalms 18, 34. He teacheth my hands to war so that a bow of steel is broken by mine arms. Now, I don't know all that's going on here. I don't know if these guys had special martial training or what. When you start talking about the Tachmonite who defeated 600 men, when it starts talking about David's mighty men, there's something more than just you know, normal sparring going on. And whether it's the Lord giving supernatural, you know, abilities at times, or whether it's a system of training, I don't know. I just know you wouldn't want to tangle with any of these mighty men. I mean, this is not just SEAL training. It must be something even more. Go on down to 1 Samuel 18, verse 6. And it came to pass as they came, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul. So they're going out to meet King Saul and the parade. They're going to give him homage. But Saul has just seen his son Jonathan strip his robe and weaponry off and give it to David. And he's going, And out come these ladies to sing songs to Saul. It says to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, and with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000. So even though they were singing it to Saul, Saul recognized that they were giving David credit for a victory over tens of thousands, and it ate him alive. Verse 8, and Saul was very wroth. I mean, don't mess with Saul's headlines. Don't mess with Saul's reputation. Don't mess with Saul's throne, because he'll kill you. Verse 8, and Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000s. To me they have ascribed but thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day and forward. So he gave him the eye. He kept his eye on him. He eyed him all the time. He always thought David was up to something, was trying to get his throne away. Verse 10. And it came to pass on the morrow that, there he's back, the evil spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied in the midst of the house. So I'm thinking that all the times that this evil spirit came upon him, that part of the equation was Saul then prophesying. And so he's saying some things about himself. He's saying some things about David that may have been true, but it was really, I mean, it was eating him up that it was true. And so he prophesied in the midst of the house, and David played with his hand as at other times, and there was a javelin in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the javelin, for he said, I will smite David even to the wall with it. And David avoided out of his presence twice. And Saul was afraid of David. He's afraid of him because the Lord was with him and was departed from Saul. Therefore, Saul removed him from him, made him his captain over 1,000. So David's been set at some level or another above the men of war, and now he's given 1,000 to be their captain. So in the midst of trying to get him away from him, Saul is basically promoting David, setting David up to have yet more power. Verse 14, and David behaved himself wisely. I'm sorry, I didn't finish verse 13, did I? And he went out and came in before the people. So he's going in and out to war. The people are all seeing him come and go. He is getting more popular than Saul. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Says that again. Verse 15. Wherefore, when Saul saw that he behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. They wanted Saul to go out before them and fight their battles. David's the one that did it, and so now they look to David almost as their leader. Verse 17, and Saul said to David, behold, my elder daughter Merab, her will I give thee to wife, only be thou valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul said, let not mine hand be upon him, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him. Now, run this forward a few years. Here is Saul contemplating or planning to use the Philistines' hands to kill David. David messes up with Bathsheba, and he uses the enemy's hands to plot and kill Bathsheba's husband. Things can turn on a dime in a spiritual life. Because you're doing well this year doesn't mean you'll be doing well next. You got to stay on your toes, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walketh about as a roaring lion. You may fulfill the very things that somebody else wickedly fulfilled toward you. It's just a sad truth. Verse 17. Saul said, "Let not mine hand be upon him, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him." And David said unto Saul, "Who am I, and what is my life, or my father's family in Israel, that I should be the son-in-law to the king?" David doesn't think he's worthy of taking Saul's daughter to wife. Verse 19, "But it came to pass, at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given unto Adriel the Meholathite to wife. And Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. And Saul said, I will give him her, that she may be a snare to him." Now, Saul's using his own daughter to try to trap David into doing something stupid, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. "Wherefore Saul said to David, Thou shalt this day be my son-in-law in the one of the twain." And so he said, "You didn't marry the first one, but I'll let you marry the second one." And he's hoping that she'll be the death of him. So it's pretty underhanded stuff. Amen? Human nature is not pretty when exposed. Any questions or comments? We got to close here. Bryce.